Welcome to the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast with your host, Dr. Yoni Rosenblad. In this episode, our esteemed guest, Dr. Tom Walters, shares his candid and insightful perspectives on the current landscape of physical therapy, offering hot takes that challenge traditional notions and spark conversations within the field. From the evolving role of physical therapists to innovative approaches in education, this episode aims to push boundaries and stimulate critical thinking. Whether you're a seasoned professional in the field or a student aspiring to become a physical therapist, Dr. Tom Walters provides a fresh perspective on where the profession stands today and where it might be headed in the future. This conversation delves into the nuances of the evolving healthcare landscape and the continuous transformation of physical therapy as a discipline. Let's jump right in.
We got another great conversation that I just had with Dr. Tom Walters. He has such an eclectic background. He's a doctor of physical therapy. He's an orthopedic certified specialist. He runs his own practice. He also has experience working with Cirque du Soleil and will get far into the weeds of his manual therapy fellowship. He is an OMPT. Dr. Walters does a great job of discussing the way he would structure the education of physical therapists. Also talks about the future, how he sees the field of physical therapy evolving and where he thinks it'll be in 10 years. I can't wait to hear your guys' feedback. Getting Tom on the podcast really came from this awesome listenership and family and tribe that we're building around the True Sports Physical Therapy podcast. So thank you so much for the recommendation. I learned a tremendous amount during this conversation, and so will you. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Tom Walters. Welcome to the True Sports Physical Therapy podcast. Dr. Tom Walters, you got a lot to teach us and a lot to share. So I want to dive right in, and of course, thank you for being here. So welcome.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on. Hopefully I've got something to share.
you've got tons to share, and your background, like I share with our audience, is extensive, from writing to practicing PT to teaching pain science. You have such an eclectic background, and so what I want you to do is, from your field of view and with all of that experience, describe for us how you see the state of the physical therapy field now.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think, obviously my perspective has evolved and changed over time like anyone would. I've been out for 17 years practicing, and, you know, it's interesting. I think in any field, you see the pendulum kind of swing, and you see that for sure in physical therapy. And I remember advisors telling me in my first few years as a clinician that this would happen, but, you know, you don't have enough years under your belt to see it. So, you know, I think the state of the field, I feel that there's both positives and negatives. And I think sometimes when you're on social media, sometimes you can see more of the negatives and criticisms about the field. And for sure those exist. I mean, I think there's things we'll get into and talk about, but I think overall, when I look at it, where it's at now compared to when I graduated in 2007, I do think that we're getting better. And I think a lot of that is that social media speeds things up. You know, you used to always hear about how long it would take for something to go from research to clinical practice. And I think that that process is probably faster now. We're talking about things in the research and what things are valid and reliable and what things aren't. And I do think that even when you look at pain science, you know, when I went through my DPT program, there was not a course on that. You know, I came out very postural, structural, biomechanical in my thinking of every patient that came in. And it really took a lot of, it was just by accident, I guess, that I found sort of the pain neuroscience community of PTs. But I think that when I look at newer grads, and a lot of my undergrad kinesiology students went to PT school, and I see them coming out, they have a much better grasp, I think, on kind of the whole person and everything that goes into pain. So I do think we're getting better. But again, if you're only on social media, you might think that we're doomed and the profession's going to just crumble or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's true of every topic and every sector, right? That social media has a habit of showing us the negative. I think that's clickbait. I think what we have come a really long way on is merging this rehab with strength and conditioning and performance. I think that was nowhere. I've been out 15, 16 years, and that was nowhere to be found. And now it's commonplace. So I think social media has really sped that up. What do we need to do? What do we need to get better at as physical therapists from your point of view?
Yeah, I think what you just brought up is one area that I think more PTs need to be, I always think it's interesting that PT schools let you come in with any undergrad degree, you know, you have to have, of course, have your prerequisites, but I had an exercise science degree and I think that was huge, right? Like huge. I went and did my CSCS and I think having knowledge in exercise physiology and strength and conditioning, I took that for granted when I started out as a PT, and you realize how many PTs didn't have that background. Maybe they weren't athletes, they weren't involved in strength and conditioning, they hadn't had an exercise physiology or exercise science undergrad degree. I think that's an area where is discussed online, and I think it's true. And like you said, it is getting way better. I mean, I remember when I came out of school, if you had the PT background and a strength and conditioning background, you were sort of like, you were an anomaly in a way. It was like you could go create a business and you had this thing you could market that not many people had. And now we're seeing more and more PTs bringing that in, especially when you think about cash practices and tying strength and conditioning together. So, but I do think we can get better there. I still think that a lot of PTs can get better in thinking about not just the basic kind of rehab exercises, but loading patients more heavily and just knowing more about strength and conditioning principles. You know, maybe it's doing the CSCS and just learning some of that stuff. I think the other side is getting better at therapy. Like, I think a lot of physical therapists, the longer I've been in this, the more I realize physical therapy is very much at least probably 50% therapy.
Yeah. And by therapy, you mean talk therapy.
Totally. Yes. Like just communicating with patients, understanding their desired, like what they're expecting from what their goals are, their outcomes they're hoping to get from coming to physical therapy. A lot of questions that I wasn't great at asking early on as a PT. It was like I had my goals. And that was just, I assume, kind of where their goals. And I think the longer I'm in this, the more I realize people often really have a story and different layers and factors that go into their pain and their injury. And just kind of peeling those back. And it's a necessary part of really helping a person, you know, optimize their recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me push back on something you said. You said that you think it's eye-opening or crazy, to use a word you did not use, that kinesiology or movement science is not a prerequisite as an undergraduate degree going into grad school. I look at my grad path. I was a kines major at the University of Maryland. And when I got to grad school, I felt like, crap, I'm gonna relearn human movement. I'm gonna relearn biomechanics. And I was missing all of these other skills, whether they be soft skills or specifically for what I do now for a living, the business side of things. I wish I would have done an undergraduate in business. I wish I would have done an undergraduate maybe in psychology to kind of bolster all the crap that I learned in graduate school, which I felt like, wait a minute, I just learned this for 3.5 years at College Park. Why am I relearning these things? I think there is value in having and learning skills that you are not going to get in graduate school. If I had to rewrite the program, I would do two things. One, you kind of just touched on, which actually came up in a recent Adam Grant book that I'm reading on corporate psychology or in perfecting and moving along one's career trajectory, which is the idea of sketch comedy and how a lot of medical schools are integrating sketch comedy into their medical school education so that their future doctors are learning how to interact on the fly, learning how to ask questions, learning how to listen vis-a-vis these sketch comedy ideas. Now, that's not a course to offer in class, but maybe a class to offer in your curriculum. I got no business education when I was learning. And by the way, I've heard you pontificate on chiropractors and their ability to sell and run a business. And God knows they are getting marketing and they are getting business strategy in their grad programs. I wish that was a part of what we are putting into our PT's brain. And it's not. It's, I think, too much movement science and not enough of these either soft or business skills.
Yeah, I totally agree with you in a lot of ways. I mean, if I think about redesigning a PT program the way I'd want it to, those are things I would think about too. We don't get any business education. There's not as much on the psychology front of things. You know, it's like you have these basic psychology classes, maybe you have one, but like actually learning active interviewing skills and just how to, you know, just listen and reframe questions, reframe what someone said. I think it's an interesting thing. It's, I can see, you know, the college I taught at was a liberal arts college, and there's a lot of value in learning things from lots of different disciplines and learning how to think before you go to graduate school. So You know, and maybe it's just that when you get to PT school, and it might just be my experience, maybe it's just that there needs to be a course or two that are really specific in strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
And maybe advanced kind of exercise physiology type principles that are specific to us as physical therapists. Maybe it's less on aerobic conditioning and it's more like loading through resistance training, something like that.
Well, I think that makes sense. I think maybe taking it a step further, I could envision a world, because the way I practice sports physical therapy is so different than the person working in the nursing home, is so different than someone working in neuro. Like, what if we had programs that were already siphoned off to say, we're not going to develop physical therapists, generalists, we're going to develop sports PTs, or we're going to develop cardiovascular PTs, we're going to develop neuro PTs. And there's so much to learn in those specialties. I think we get in trouble by creating generalists, because you come out and you're an expert in nothing.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. I mean, I look at the value of the residency I did, and I think that's essentially what it did. Is I came out and in the first year did a residency, and it totally boosted me ahead in terms of orthopedic manual physical therapy. If I, just like you said, if I had just come out with the knowledge that I had, luckily my program was geared a little more orthopedic, so it almost was helping in the direction I wanted to go. But I agree with you. I mean, every physician has to do a residency. Yep. PT, you can come out and just be a generalist and just stay a generalist and really be kind of a, you know, a specialist in nothing. So it would be cool to have programs where, you know, that like of these, I was just looking at the list of them, there's 301 PT schools now. Like, say there were some that were like neuro focused.
Yeah.
These ones are ortho focused. These ones are sports focused. That'd be pretty cool, you know. And maybe you get in there and it's like undergrad, where maybe every PT school has a, it introduces you to each of those areas, but then you choose your track or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the basics. I could foresee a Walters Rosenblatt Institute in the future.
I like it.
Yeah. I feel like we could come up with a better name than that. Okay. So, but this is a great segue. I got to stop sending questions to my guests beforehand, because you nailed this segue. You did a manual therapy residency. And you're talking to a guy, when I came out of school, I was obsessed with putting my hands on patients and making them feel better. I just wanted to be the world's best manual therapist. And I took a left-hand turn once I started to get into some of the literature on manual therapy. Tell me about the most important thing you learned in your manual therapy residency. And then, looking back on it, what do you think now was just total eyewash?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the best thing I got from it was actually just kind of the model in the way that they approached orthopedic physical therapy, which they were very good in that manual therapy, that particular residency. I think they were good in teaching that a lot of the things we do in terms of special testing and manual therapy are not that special. And so I appreciated that they were like that early on, that it was more of just a test, treat, retest model. And I thought that was really useful in terms of just like, can I reproduce my patient's symptoms, treat them, and then retest, and did their symptoms change? And let's not get really deep into saying it's this mechanism or that mechanism that changed them. Because I've been in other programs where they do think, oh, you can palpate this and find asymmetry, and when you treat it, it's going to change their alignment or move this thing biomechanically. And I just think the evidence doesn't support that.
Yeah.
And so I've been exposed to different groups. I had my manual therapy residency, and then I did all the courses. For a while, I was at Texas Tech doing a doctorate of science, and I did the COMT through another group. And that group was very specific. And I think any program like that you go through, as long as you go into it with the right mental framework and have some knowledge of the evidence, of course, you're going to get good things from it. But I think you have to kind of put that stuff in its place. And the second one I went through, they thought we could be more specific than I think we can based on the evidence.
Yeah.
And so I think the thing that was the best of those residencies was just thinking about the kind of this principle, like I said, of kind of test, treat, retest, and just kind of keeping it simple. Probably the downside of those programs were the ones that I think what we're seeing in the research is this, that we can't be as, like, if you're, you know, one of those programs initially would have said, you know, would have taught us like looking at ASIS, PSIS, like upslip, downslip, anterior posterior rotation, like looking at pelvic asymmetry, leg length asymmetries. And I think the more we look at that research, we see that people have asymmetries. They just have bony asymmetries for one, and expert clinicians can't identify reliably. They don't agree on these visual changes. So I think I am way less specific these days in terms of kind of like my manual assessment, posture, looking at alignment and structure. I just don't spend as much time on it. I'd rather just be able to see if I can reproduce the person's familiar symptoms, because I think that helps guide me. And then, you know, maybe it's, and I do way less manual therapy than I used to. You know, I used to be in a clinic where literally they came in and every patient, we just did 30 minutes and then they went to someone else for the exercise. So it's like, I'm just doing manual therapy all day. And I'm not like that any at all anymore. I mean, there might be something where it's just a couple few minutes to try and kind of help desensitize something like that. But then it's really, we know movement and exercise has the best evidence. So getting them moving, gradually loading, thinking about kind of graded exposure, just in building capacity, especially through resistance training. But that's kind of, I do less manual therapy than I did early in my career.
I mean, you use the term desensitization, which to me screams more of a neuro input than anything else, and biomechanical input for sure. What would your residency instructors say should they hear you talk about, I'm going to desensitize the structure before I go out and load them?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. The person who taught my initial residency is fully on board that he teaches pain science now. And so I know I don't know if we went back to that year, 2008, when I did that, he'd probably be like, what are you talking about, bro? But I think where he's at now and his education followed the evidence like mine did. I know now he's like, oh, that totally makes sense. You're providing a novel input into the nervous system, and that's probably changing the pain output more than we're changing the structure or quality of some tissue or moving some joint to a different position, any of that stuff.
Yeah, which by the way, correct me if I'm wrong, that would, I would think, support any joint manipulation we do in terms of giving a different input to the nervous system to allow for either better range of motion or decreased pain through range of motion versus I'm going to realign things of that nature, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot of fighting about, you know, the efficacy of things like spinal manipulation and different mobilizations and things. And I get it. I get, you know, where that's coming from, whether it's, you know, if you're looking at, is this a non-specific kind of placebo mechanism, or is it something that's happening at the tissue level? I'm sure there's a mix of that happening with every person. And to me, sometimes I just think, as long as it's not coming with some harmful message that creates dependency, if it only takes a few minutes and it helps knock pain down a little bit so that you can start loading them and moving them, to me, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. As long as you're not saying, hey, you have to do this, I'm putting your spine back in alignment, you've got to keep coming back so I can set you straight.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. So tell me where dry needling plays a part in your practice, whether you guys do that. And then also I would lump in cupping and instrument assisted soft tissue work. True Sports Physical Therapy is growing like wildfire. We have 14 locations, soon to be more. We are throughout the state of Maryland. We're in Pennsylvania, in Lebanon and York, Pennsylvania, as well as in Delaware, in Newark and Wilmington, Delaware. Like I said, so many more practices to come, and we always need outstanding sports physical therapists. Our treatment style is unique. We are one-on-one with your athlete for 45 minutes every single session. You do the entire treatment, you do the entire evaluation, and they are in state-of-the-art facilities where you have room to run, throw and jump and really get your athlete all the way back to on the field and better and stronger than they were. We also have outstanding salaries, comp structures, bonus abilities, 401ks, as well as a very strong continuing education offering, including in-house continuing education. And we're looking for you. Now is the time, as we are growing like crazy. Just shoot your resume over to Yoni, Y-O-N-I, at True Sports PT, or shoot us a DM and we will hit you back. We will get you in for our unique tried and true interview process and really make a determination that this is the right place for you to grow your career and get your athletes better than ever. We can't wait to hear from you.
I don't do any of those modalities, and that's not really because I don't really have anything really hugely against. I mean, when I was writing the book, I kind of went through, kind of refreshed my memory, just went back and looked at current studies on dry needling and acupuncture. And I think there are some showing that it does better than sham, some newer studies. So in California, we actually can't pierce the skin. So I'm not even allowed to do dry needling.
That's ridiculous, Tom. Yeah. Change that immediately.
Totally. And, you know, but I do think, like manipulation, like massage, like, look, if you're going to do any kind of soft tissue work on people and then criticize dry needling, acupuncture, and cupping, I mean, there's a problem there. There's a conflict because massage is giving the same type of novel input into the receptors in the skin, just like cupping would, or acupuncture, or dry needling. So I think you'd be a little bit of a hypocrite if you'd say I do any of these other types of manual therapy, but I don't think there's any evidence for these. I mean, they're still affecting the skin. So yeah. I'm not against those really. It's just that I can't, for one, do dry needling in California. And then in terms of like cupping and any kind of like scraping or grass, I just haven't taken courses on them. So I think I haven't ever felt like I needed to add that to what I do, because I felt like I could accomplish those things with my hands-on skills. And then I'm obviously just going to move them towards exercise anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, I've come a long way on the dry needling world. I have a sister-in-law who is a tried and true acupuncturist, and I thought she was absolutely full of crap for a decade. And then once I got into needling and saw my ease of joint mobilization manipulation following needling, and I realized what the impact needling can have locally, at least on muscle tissues and muscle tension, I really became a strong believer. Another thing that I found good use for is aggravating those tissues to incur blood flow, to allow it to withstand more pressure. And I've seen good use, like with a patellar tendonitis that's having pain with knees over toes stuff, to needle it and then take them down to the gym. And all of a sudden they're able to do more. At least I have found a role for it. Why the hell is it not allowed in California?
Yeah, I think it's just the lobbying power of, you know, partly, I don't know if it's the AMA so much, but more just I think it must be the acupuncturist. It must be money. Just, I feel like it always comes down to those things. Because I don't think the physicians probably really care about if PTs are doing dry needling,
No.
I think the acupuncturist must have some money and that sort of prevents it. But I agree with you. I've had dry needling done, and I think I'm normally a really skeptical person. So I go into most things, I feel like being a little more resistant to placebo, like just that's the science side of me. And when I was practicing in Colorado for a little while, I had one of the other physios there did some dry needling on my levator at one point, and it was interesting. I could see, like you said, a role for it. You know, when you have something that's acute, you can get in there and have some local effects on something, or interestingly, you say, like maybe being able to create an inflammatory response to kind of get some blood flow in the area, and maybe that reduces some sensitivity so you can load them. I could see places for it.
Yeah. And I think it's like so many things. I think PRP is an awesome example where you got to be careful that you don't just become the PRP guy or the dry needling guy where, hey, this is all I do. And I'm going to apply it to everyone. I think you just have to be sensitive and intelligent upon when you do those things. But that brings me to my next question, which is around biologics. Tell me what you're seeing with the PRP stem cell world, how often you're seeing it, and how much of an effect do you think it has one way or another?
Yeah, I think like you're kind of alluding to there, I think it can have its place, but you don't. I think there's a physician buddy here that I talked to that spends a lot of time in the world of continuing education related to PRP. And he's mostly a hip surgeon, but he does use PRP with a lot of those patients that meet certain criteria for kind of pain relief. And I think, again, even when I was writing the book and going through, I have a whole chapter on complementary and alternative medicine interventions. And I went through and looked at the current research on PRP and stem cell. And I think a lot of it was still going back to this idea that it can have a role when it comes to relieving pain. But often the issue is that the formulas aren't standardized. So if you go see different physicians, there might be a different formula for it. And so maybe there is a particular formula that really has great efficacy, but maybe we just haven't found it yet. And I seem to see this. There's another physician, orthopedic physician I talk to on Instagram from time to time. He kind of specializes in this area, and he's kind of said the same. He was one of the authors actually on one of the studies. So I, in terms of patients coming in, again, like how much of it is them, you know, if you believe something's going to help you, It's probably going to help you. And so I've had a mix. It may be split. I probably have had a split mix of people who feel like it was like really hugely helpful and changed their symptoms and allowed them to function better. And other people who are like, didn't do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other caveat there is the shutdown period following. So how long is that shutdown period? If you're treating a tendinopathy, would they just have gotten better by putting them in a boot if it's an Achilles tendinopathy versus the biologic intervention? You make a great point, which I think is totally worth noting, is what do you mean when you say PRP? What are they actually spinning down? What are they actually putting in? I think there's so much gray. I think it's really naive and novice for us to think we have figured it out when it's so hard to test. It's almost like a diet across a massive population. There's so many other factors that we're not calculating. I think it's worth diving into. You mentioned your book, Rehab Science, and it is a monstrosity, as my mother would say. It's massive. And so like as you were putting together that book, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is really like a Bible towards given pathologies that you see and how to treat them intelligently. And so when you went through that and you're basically doing a massive lit review on every pathology, what opened your eyes and be like, Jesus, I was wrong on this?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, basically the book kind of breaks down. It's got the first initial chapters on pain, then injury. So looking at all the kind of separating those, where are pain and injury similar, where are they different, looking at that research again, and then going through all the different sort of the conditions that I would see commonly in the orthopedic kind of outpatient clinic. And, but yeah, you asking about what stood out to me as I went back through things, I think honestly, the things that stood out to me were the complementary and alternative medicine type interventions, because I just hadn't spent a lot of time reading those. You know, I just was looking at people on social media, like, acupuncture's got some, dry needling has some research. It's all bullshit. Don't do it at all. And yeah. So it was interesting for me to actually go back through and kind of look at current research. And I think acupuncture was one that was surprising to me, where finding some newer studies that where it did do better than sham. I thought that was interesting. And not that surprising. It's kind of what I felt at a gut level, like we were talking about. If it's going to provide some novel input, why couldn't it change the pain experience just like manual therapy does? So, and movement does. So I think that topic area, going through all of those, we kind of went through and ranked different types of complementary alternative medicine interventions in a hierarchy of what had more evidence down to kind of what had less. So everything, things at the top were things like cross transfer and like visual, like mental imagery, you know, things that, there's more research for. What else was up there? I can't even think of what else was at the top. It seems like everything I just want to put at the bottom. But, you know, of course, like at the very, yeah. So I think that was probably the area. Most of the actual conditions, I don't feel like I came, which was, I guess, probably encouraging. I came away from it generally feeling like I had going into the book.
Yeah. You know? Well, so, at least it's validating. I would say, like, when I sat for my OCS exam, it's really what turned my head away from this sacroiliac joint mediated pain. I'm like, what the hell have I been doing for the last 5 years treating SI joints when the literature doesn't even support my ability to feel where it is, let alone the patient, let alone another therapist. So that kind of opened my mind. I think it's a strong point, whether you're going to write your own book or whether you're going to sit for a board examination, it's such a great refresher to actually sit and read the literature, not read someone's take on the literature, not read an Instagram post on the literature, but to read this full body of literature that we have at present day, which is always evolving. And then to, hey, am I going to be humble enough to change the way I treat? I think that was really hard for me, just from an ego perspective, to think, man, like all the patients I thought I quote unquote fixed, I was probably doing something else. It wasn't me manipulating their SI joint.
Yeah, that's a huge one. I mean, I had the same kind of change away from that, where I used to spend a lot of time looking at leg length asymmetries and pelvic obliquities and trying to assess that stuff visually. And, oh, I got to make sure I'm standing on the right side so that my dominant eye is looking at their pelvis, and, you know, and implementing interventions where I thought, oh, okay, you've got a anterior rotation, your right side, or posterior rotation, your left side. I'm literally going to do this muscle energy technique, and oh yeah, your pelvis looks better. Like I'm rechecking it. I really believed I was doing all those things. And I think I agree with you. We just can't be that specific, and we're probably not changing things that way. SI joint pain, I included it in the book, but what I did was I didn't make it its own separate thing. I included it in the low back pain program because ultimately at the end of the day, I think that the basics help most people when it comes to movement and exercise. And so if you can teach people again, like how to identify their aggravating activities, identify triggers and things like that, and how to kind of learn some of these principles so that you can modify a program that allows you to challenge the area of sensitivity in graded doses, whether you have back pain that's potentially due to a disc insult or a facet joint or the SI joint, the programs ultimately kind of look very similar. So
yeah,
early in my career, I probably wouldn't have thought that at all. I would have thought SI joint needs this very specific type thing that's different from like a facet joint issue or a back strain or something, you know, but that's how you evolve, I guess.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of that is we make things so complicated so that we can be the experts, or one given person can be the experts. And when in fact, so much of it is so simple. So I think there's a ton there to kind of chew on. One of the things I love about you, it's easy to talk PT education with you because of your vast experience, but also your hands are currently still on patients, which is awesome. And then you have this fascinating background of treating Cirque du Soleil and what I would just bucket as the hypermobile athlete. And the hypermobile athlete keeps me up at night way more than the hypomobile athlete. So I would love to dive into this hypermobile world, being that you're the expert on this phone call. So when you're assessing a Cirque du Soleil athlete and they have back pain, can you just walk us through how you organize that evaluation and what you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, they're much more challenging than the hypomobile person. They just, you know, when people can move through that degree of range of motion, it is much harder oftentimes to actually provoke their symptoms and get an idea of what the heck's going on. And even when you're looking at what you're going to prescribe with them, it's, you just think about somebody who comes in with back pain. Okay, so like you are going to do a straight leg raise as one of your assessment, you know, one of your tests or whatever to look at. The hypomobile person, it's like it's so easy to reproduce their symptoms. Their leg barely goes anywhere. You have some contortionist. I mean, you're literally putting them in side splits and they're barely getting anything. Yep. But they seem to have, they've got back pain and maybe they have some that radiates down, and you think in the hypomobile person, this would be so easy to reproduce. But in them, it's incredibly challenging. And I had, there was a group of contortionists on the show that I was on, and back one of them in particular had a lot of back pain, and she was also Russian. So it was interesting culturally because she really didn't want to talk about having pain. Yeah. And then on top of that, extremely hypermobile in her spine. And so trying to figure out, you know, going back to that model of like, I'm going to test and see if I can reproduce familiar symptoms and then treat and retest, it's really challenging in those individuals because so many of the tests, you're moving them through this huge wide range of motion and not reproducing much. It was almost like, you know, in some of those cases, the easiest thing for me to reproduce with was just palpation. Some of the movement-based, mobility-based kind of assessments were very challenging, you know? So I think there's still, you know, when I think about those individuals, there would still be cases where I would give them something, a mobility type strategy, but it wasn't to increase mobility. It would be if you could reproduce that symptom. And then it goes back to just, can I desensitize them in a position they need to be able to get into for their activity? So maybe it is like that, you know, that gymnast or the contortionist that it needs to be able to do the side splits or something like that, but also has back pain and seems to maybe have some radicular symptoms. And so of course they can go well beyond the normal range of motion. And I'm not doing that. They've got full range for what they need. It's just that they're hitting kind of a pain barrier. And so it's like, can I go up to that pain barrier and use a sciatic nerve mobilization technique at that end range position just to desensitize them?
Yeah.
You know, when I had that position, it was, I was very early on in this journey. I was 2010. So I'd only been out of school 3 years. I had just barely started dipping my toes into pain science. So it's interesting now. Most of the people I interact with now are the regular individual, and most of them are more, they're probably more on the hypomobile side of the spectrum, you know? Right. So I do think that they are easier to treat. Where do you, I mean, and I, the other thing too, maybe is right. When you think about back pain, a lot of times you'll hear that, okay, let's break this down into right off the bat. Is the person more hypomobile or are they more hypermobile? And the old sort of criteria of like, okay, well, this hypomobile person is going to go more towards mobility interventions, which I feel like most people with back pain are hypomobile. Usually mobility, hip and mobility, or hip and lumbar mobility exercises tend to help them.
Yep.
The hypermobile, you know, and you're going more towards the old like stability
right.
Strengthening, all that stuff. What do you, how do you feel about it?
I mean, that is the way I like to bucket it. I think you're making a good point. You got to meet that athlete where they are. And so, you know, I'll have running backs that come in that are built like a ton of bricks and they're so strong, but it's a matter of, okay, where are they not? You know, if I think it's a strength deficit, let's find what, how can I prove to myself and to them that there is a weakness here to work on? I would say the same thing with hyper. Like I think the struggle you get into, or maybe one of the stumbling blocks is, this person is hypermobile. They're in the freaking Cirque du Soleil. Like God knows they have enough mobility. So I'm not going to even look there. But are there structures that have become tighter? And not to just totally X out the idea that this person could be tight somewhere and I want to teach them how to mobilize or treat that tissue or whatever it is. But most of my intervention will probably be stability in nature, depending upon how they present. I think you got to be careful of this person's in Cirque du Soleil. You know they're hypermobile. They must be all stability. No, usually it's a hodgepodge. So that would be the way I approach that. I think some of the struggle is like those athletes, those Cirque du Soleil athletes are so mobile, but they're also super strong, right? So I would ask you, I'd flip it back to you and say like, if you're going to start to introduce core activation or stability training in hopes of giving them a better base upon which to work, where do you start with that? How do you introduce that core stabilization to a population like that? Hey guys, quick pause and a quick shout out to this new masterclass that we just launched here at True Sports Physiotherapy. Myself and Dr. Tim Stone put together a masterclass of ACL rehab, and we call it From Table to Turf. And the reason we call it that is because it's going to teach you exactly how to get your athlete all the way from post-op day one with the nitty-gritty of regaining all of that range of motion with the tips and the tricks that we use here at True Sports Physiotherapy that gets our athletes better, faster, and stronger. And that's early. And then how do you progress that athlete all the way onto the field with a ball in their foot or a stick in their hand or whatever their sport is and teach them how to accelerate, how to decel, how to change direction, and all the mechanics that go in there. What drills do we use to get our athletes exactly where they need to be, back on the field, and even better than before injury? And I want you to sign up for that class. Now, you can find it on our website. You can shoot us a direct message and just say, hey, send me the course. It's right now on sale, so make sure you sign up now. It is fully accredited to get you all of your continuing education hours. Sign up for the True Sports Masterclass ACL From Table to Turf. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would say I totally agree with what you're saying before, not to overgeneralize and just think this person is in this type of role or position, you know, like a contortionist. So they're just going to be hypermobile everywhere, because definitely you see people, right? Like I'd have lots of examples of people who were really hypermobile in their lumbar spine, but their thoracic spine and maybe certain directions of their hip were hypomobile.
Yeah.
And so thinking about those adjacent joint regions biomechanically and how it, there's just nuance, right? There's nuance to all these kind of discussions in each person. And yeah, when it comes to strengthening, you know, thinking about like a weak link or something that you think might be associated with their pain, some of those individuals actually weren't strong. You know, I mean, like the contortionists were a good example. The contortionists weren't really doing that much in terms of handling load. And if they were, it was on passive tissues. It was like they were just hanging out at end range and stacking things. So in some ways, they were probably the easiest people to kind of get going in terms of just introducing, I think, kind of just motor control at a base level initially, like just how do you activate, you know, these kind of core trunk muscles, and then building strength I mean, I think I used to be so, this is another area where I've changed. I used to be so nitpicky and specific when it came to motor control and how people, you know, I'd look at like a single leg bridge and I was like, oh, the contralateral side of their pelvis dropped half an inch. Like, this is a problem. Yeah. And you need to bring that side up. And I, for sure, there's a place for movement quality, but I think sometimes it's more important just to focus on building strength and progressing load over time, as long as it's not flaring them up. And it's, I worry a little less about it needs to look totally perfect.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that a lot of times that, again, this is back in 2010 when I was there. So my approach now would be different. Back then, I would have been really specific about teaching, observing different movements, and then trying to correct fine little details in motor control. And I think I've moved away from that over time. And I think really I'm more focused on basic strength, fundamental movement patterns, and just gradually increasing load in those and not worrying quite so much about like how perfect their form is.
Yeah. You sound like a strength coach. I mean, which is, I think a sign of a good PT, but obviously I'm biased. When's the last time you used the term, no, just squeeze your transversus abdominis when core stuff? Is that gone?
Yeah, it's gone. The last time,
2010.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I taught for an organization for a long time that I think it was called Redcord, and it's a Norwegian-based suspension system. And they are heavily focused on these nitty-gritty kind of biomechanical details, which they do help a lot of people. But I think it's more about their system sort of, it builds in progressive overload and graded exposure through their bungee system. It offloads people. You have a bungee system that goes around the pelvis, so you can take off some of their body weight. And over time, you release the bungee, and so you're doing full body weight. And I think that was more of what was really happening with that system versus like these tiny little tweaks. And because we did do a lot of, okay, transit, we'd palpate transverse abdominis, palpate multifidus, like, can you turn these two on? Okay, think about your pelvic floor and all that stuff. And I don't want to, you know, I do think sometimes there is a place for those things, but I just think it's way less people. It was almost like I was doing that with everyone as the first step before. And I do way less of it now.
Yeah, I think it's such a great way to prevent a patient from coming back for visit number two when you're talking about transversus and multifidus and they're not going to get in the first session. And I just saw so many patients start to fall off versus the way I approach it now, which is, how do we get your core stronger? Let's get your abs stronger. Let's get your glutes strong. Like, just talking in more macroscopic terms, I've seen land better. And by the way, like, can we really palpate transversus? Can you really identify? Can you really isolate it? Probably not. Or at least I haven't figured out how. So I think there's value in what's going to land with the patient. It kind of bleeds into this next idea, which is when you're dealing with a Cirque du Soleil, or in my world, like I'm dealing with guys in the NFL and they're in season, or Cirque du Soleil is constantly performing, how are you able to carve out time to actually load, make an athlete sore, to see some change? How did you balance that with their performance schedule?
Man, that part is really hard. Even since leaving Cirque, and when I was working as a PT at the college here before, kind of while I was doing some teaching and seeing a lot of the athletes, and man, that is a tricky, that's a fine line to balance on. It just, how can I load this person but not contribute to maybe the overloading they're getting, just this tissue's being loaded more than it's surpassing its capacity just in their training and their practice and games. And how do I kind of take it through these phases of like, how can I desensitize it and calm it back down and then load it again to increase capacity so that they're less like, it is very challenging for the in-season athlete. Like you said, Cirque du Soleil, they're doing it year round. So
right.
You know, I think it was, I don't know that I have a perfect answer for it. It was, to be honest, some of it was Cirque. And I think some of it was just more focused on pain modulation and like recognizing that I don't know if I'm maybe going to do more harm by trying to load this tissue more. Right. Because they've got to be out there six nights a week doing two shows a night. And in the back of your head, you're thinking, this seems like a recipe for disaster and just a more serious, you know, a more significant injury at some point that actually just makes them sit out or be out from the shows. I feel like at that time period, so much of what I was focused on was just, can I calm things down so that they can keep going?
Yeah, it's a different approach. I mean, it's a really different approach. One thing I've done with my football guys is living a little bit more with blood flow restrictions. So, you know, so I'm actually putting less load through the tissue, but systemically incurring some type of hormonal response to incur, whether it be activation or growth. At least I can do that without trying to load the tissue. Probably didn't have that in 2010, but I think this is where great PTs become or should be great strength coaches, which is looking at the entire volume of training and figuring out where are they? Where are they in their periodization or in their schedules and trying to kind of dip your toe in the water? You're right. Now that I think about it, like you were functioning more of a Band-Aid guy than a fix-it guy, right? Yeah. With CERC. Hopefully like in your given populations, you're able to dance between both. I think it can be challenging.
And I think what you said there is a great point, you know, not only looking at the volume of loading within their program, but then also just like, well, what's the rest of the kinetic chain look like? You know, that the concept of you have symptoms in this area, but all the research we have on thinking about, okay, well, I've got a knee issue. What can I be, could I be loading you at the hip more? What's going on loading wise there? What's going on at the, kind of like we were talking about mobility. It's like if somebody's hypermobile in their lumbar spine, what's happening at the thoracic region, at the hip? Yeah. Same with strength, like in that kinetic chain. Again, going back to, I maybe am not so concerned with kind of fine details on movement patterns, but just thinking about how can loading those help to maybe unload that sensitive area?
Yeah. Yeah. That tidbit, like that's a viral tidbit. Like I think that is something that all sports PTs need to understand and can apply so readily tomorrow to their patient to say, okay, you got a game on Sunday. Well, Thursday, Friday, we're going to be hitting, you know, if it's knee pain, we're going to be hitting glute posterior chain and it's going to hopefully offload. I think there's tremendous value there. So thanks for pointing that out. Okay. Let me close with the Eric Cressy lightning round. Ready, Tom?
Ready.
Buckle up. Here we go. Who is the best PT in the world not named Tom Walters?
You know, honestly, I would say my orthopedics professor, a guy named Steve Fertig, who unbelievable orthopedic PT. He practices and teaches. He's at the University of Montana. I was with him here in Southern California. I grew up in Montana, so it's funny. He's living in Montana now and teaching there, but unbelievable orthopedic kind of spine specialist PT. He sent so many people to him. I learned so much about orthopedic practice from him. But nobody, you know, not a ton of people, his students know how good he is.
Well, that's the wrong answer. The right answer is Kelly Starrett, but I guess that guy's good too. Okay. What is the biggest career mistake you have made and what did you learn from it?
The biggest career mistake I made was business related. I opened a business and didn't market it. So what I thought if I opened it, they would come. I opened a biomechanics lab, a clinical biomechanics lab. I went and took Chris Powers' 6-month kind of biomechanics course. And I thought I'm going to replicate this here in Santa Barbara. And I think it was a great, could have been a really helpful business for people, but the general public didn't understand that it was relevant to them. They thought it was only for athletes and I didn't market it. I just thought I opened it to another guy. We were both working full time in other positions and just thought people would show up and just, it would grow and did that for 3 years. And then I left and like you said, I learned nothing about business in undergrad or PT school. And now kind of being in a solopreneur space, I'm trying to learn all this stuff.
Well, how could a guy with 1.2 million followers on Instagram not market their own business?
Yeah, dude, I guess, honestly, social media is, that's probably one of the biggest lessons I learned from it is that you have to be in front of people all the time. If you don't talk about what you have available, nobody's going to buy it. So yeah. I learned that more than anything with the book. And I think as I reflect back on my years on social media, one of the huge factors in what made that successful was just showing up daily and being consistent. We hear this on so many podcasts and things now, but so much of what becomes successful in life is you showing up consistently. And I think that's a big part of marketing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really good advice. Okay. So now that Rehab Science has paved the way for your retirement, what's your next book?
The next book I'm excited. We're working on them right now. We are going to put out a series of 7 smaller books that will come out in October. You probably are familiar with the McKinsey Treat Your Own Spine, Treat Your Own. Sure. So it's kind of that concept, smaller each joint region, but an updated version. Because, you know, you look at those books, there's a lot of outdated stuff in them.
Yep.
So I think there's kind of this opportunity to have, some people don't want this big textbook, 5-pound book to lug around. They want just, I want to have some exercise programs for the common shoulder issues or knee issues. So those 7 books will cover each joint region and kind of pull those sections out of the big book. So that's the next thing.
Awesome. When is that? That sounds awesome.
Yeah, those will come out in October. This year.
Oh, super cool. Okay. And so, okay, that comes out in October. Tell me where you, what you think physical therapy looks like in 10 years from now.
Yeah. I think this is an interesting one. I think, hopefully, you know, I think what I would like to see is that physical therapy, and I think we're moving this direction, but is a profession that maybe functions more like a coach. You know, and I think thinks about all of the factors that are relevant to pain and injury and not just being so myopic and focused just on the physical body, the, you know, our tissues and posture and biomechanics and things. Those for sure have their role. And I know a lot of people have been beating on this for a long time, but I just think there are so many other factors that if you were to go see a coach, that's what they would do is coach you through, I hate to use like the life coach thing, but like, you know, kind of a coach that's thinking about like, what's your nutrition look like? What is your sleep look like? Looking at the loading and exercise side of things. I just think we as humans, especially in the Western world, are not doing well. Like when you just think about how sedentary people are, the obesity rates, metabolic health issues, heart disease. I just think PTs, we need to be in a position where we're not only helping people with their pain and injury, but we're looking and we're talking through back to that kind of talk therapy side of things, but coaching them through just being healthier in all aspects of their life, because we know that all those things factor into inflammation and pain and tissue healing. I mean, just macronutrients and nutrition. And there's just so much that we don't touch on as PTs often. I hope we go there more.
Yeah. It's interesting that you think it becomes more personalized and gets, that sounds like it's moving away from the virtual space.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't know about that. I think, I don't know that it would necessarily be more focused on personal in-person. It could be that it's just nuanced, but still a telehealth kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that it has to be, because I think if you're thinking about a coaching model, it could be just like, I mean, what we're doing now, I think that a lot of coaching you can do in a virtual session, especially when you think about moving away from some of the manual therapy, hands-on stuff.
Yep.
You know, I think you, I'm sure we both saw the same thing, especially during COVID and on social media all these years. It is amazing to see how many people can get better just from good guidance and movement.
Yep.
And education, you know, education on the factors that can influence my pain and injury. What are some movements and exercises I can implement? And then is there somebody there that can help guide me on how to navigate things that come up along the way, which doesn't require touch or in-person, you know?
Yeah.
I
was going to say, I could totally see how you're positioning yourself to kind of be in that space. And that's a tremendous amount of forethought. So I'm excited to see that come to fruition. I think it's also going to increase the bandwidth of the provider where you can juggle a much larger caseload when doing that by harnessing and utilizing technology appropriately. I could totally see it going that way.
Well, it's obvious. I mean, it's not like I've spent a lot of time thinking through these things. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I listen to you and it's always great to be on a podcast because so many of them I do aren't with other PTs. So they're very basic questions that don't dive into these intricacies of our profession, but obviously you've spent time thinking about this. So it's always really cool to hear another PT who's in the entrepreneurial space and is thinking about kind of the future. I think for so long, I've just been kind of doing what I'm doing and evolving with it and not always thinking about why is this happening, like reflecting on it. Sometimes you just get caught up in the, I do these things every day because I know it grows things.
Yeah.
And so, but then stepping back and thinking about where is this actually going to go? But I think it is amazing to see with education, guidance, coaching, and movement and exercise how much people get better. Because I get criticized a lot for putting, because look, I realize I'm putting out stuff that's cookie cutter. I'm not evaluating the person.
Yep.
But after a while of evaluating humans, most of us have a handful of the same conditions. And yep. you realize, like, you see these patterns, and most people get better with loading in this way. So, yep. and I think social media to me has kind of proven that I can not be interacting with someone and putting some things out that are relatively safe and load them in a gradual way. And so many people get better.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing to think that way through. Tom, I love what you're doing. I loved your book. I'm excited to see this new series. I think that's right on point. Tell everyone where they can find you as if they don't already know, and best ways to get in touch.
Yeah. So it's just Rehab Science mainly on Instagram and YouTube. Been putting more effort over on YouTube, just kind of longer form educational stuff, mostly for the general public. The PTs listening it's going to be stuff they already know. And then rehabscience.com. And the book is called Rehab Science. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those places. So, yeah.
Dude, you sound like a marketer. You sound like you know how to market.
Yeah, it is. You slowly get better. I'm slowly learning how to market. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate you having me on, talking through these things. Honestly, talking to another PT, especially a sports PT, like we're in such similar areas, so much crossover, a little bit different, right? Like I'm seeing more of the general population at this point. You're seeing athletes, you know, but it's like there's so much crossover in the conditions that affect people in those two realms. And just cool to hear another physical therapist who's, again, kind of is in that entrepreneurial space and thinking through these things. I don't get a lot of opportunities to talk with someone like you. So,
well, I appreciate your time. I'm happy to always continue the conversation. I feel like I made a new friend. So thanks for that, Tom. And I really appreciate your time and what you're doing for the profession. It's really profound.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, man. We'll talk soon. Thanks, Tom.
All right. See ya.
Bye, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast. Thank you for your support. We really appreciate it. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, wherever it is you consume your pods. We are there. Please give us a listen. Share it with your friends. Share it with your colleagues. Leave us a 5-star review. And as always, give us a follow on Instagram, on TikTok, where we are posting constantly daily content on how to be an outstanding sports physical therapist. We appreciate you guys. We can't wait to hear from you.